Episode 34, May the 31st, 2010. Effelsberg Radio Telescope. Amongst the rolling green hills of the Eifel region of Western Germany is the 100-meter Effelsberg steerable radio telescope, similar in appearance to the Lovell telescope in Jodrell Bank, which is situated on the plains of Cheshire in northwest England and can be seen from miles away. Designed to duck much of the terrestrial radio interference, Effelsberg is in a valley, so it's easy to pass close by and miss it. If you want to have a look, see the video associated with this episode. It is an international facility operated by the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy, participating in very long baseline interferometry, where actual links are necessary with other countries. It also frequently hosts international astronomers and participates in global projects. Effelsberg has a surprisingly rich public online presence, including the current observing schedule, and of course the now mandatory live webcam. For decades, it was the largest steerable radio telescope in the world. In 2007, it became the world's first international telescope station for the then new project called LOFAR, Low Frequency Array. LOFAR targets the low frequency range between 10 MHz and 250 MHz. However, for many years, commercial radio stations, local emergency services, and the aviation industry have been using frequencies in the middle of this range, between 90 and 108 MHz, so LOFAR is split into two. A low band, between 10 and 90 MHz, and a high band, between 108 and 250 MHz. Thus, there are now three telescopes at Effelsberg. I know what you're thinking. Effelsberg is in Germany, and this is AstroTalk UK. I happened to be in the area. I met up with Dr. Norbert Junkers, who was very generous with his time.
The Effelsberg telescope has a diameter of 100 meters, and that means we have a dish of the size, you know, almost of the size of a soccer field, 9,000 square meters altogether.
Right. Uh-huh.
And that's used in the decimeter and centimeter wavelengths range, between, say, 35 centimeters and 3.5 millimeters in wavelength.
And how old is that?
This telescope was built in, it was started at the end of the 60s. Uh-huh. First observations took place in 71.
Oh, I see.
And that means almost 40 years old.
Right, so it's about 10 years after Jodrell Bank, pretty much. And it's got the record as the largest steerable radio telescope in the world.
It's had the record for, three decades,
uh-huh,
until the new Greenbank telescope in the US was finished.
Uh-huh.
And that was in the year 2000. And the new Greenbank telescope is slightly bigger. It's an azimuthal shaped dish with a diameter of 100 by 110 meters. Right. Say 102 meters effectively, then we have a telescope 2 meters more than ours.
Yeah. Behind you is the office area?
Yeah, that's the office area. There's the control room from where the telescope is steered. There are also labs where receivers are being built. There is something very interesting that is a Faraday lab.
Uh-huh.
It means we have to protect the telescope from its own analysis equipment. Since there's a lot of RFI, radio frequency interference,
uh-huh,
be it mobile phones, running car engines, or electric fences or whatever. Also, maybe your equipment is, at the moment it's not certainly not disturbing, since at the moment it's technical and maintenance time,
right.
But there is quite a bit, and also computer screens and computer CPUs,
mm-hmm,
all disturbing the telescope in that extreme range. And our radio signals are that weak.
Mm-hmm.
We have that neat comparison. What our telescope is receiving from the sky is so little power,
uh-huh,
the emitting power of a mobile phone in the distance of the moon would compare to the third strongest radio source in the sky.
Wow. You mentioned computers. Computers mostly these days have processors working in the exactly the same gigahertz range. Yes. Where you operate.
Yes.
Must cause a lot of problems for people using laptops and computers in the office here. Do you prohibit that?
That means, in principle, yes. And if you buy new laptops, say by the electronics division, whether the laptop, whether the screen really spoils the observation with the telescope.
All right. So you don't have a restriction on astronomers bringing their laptops and using them in the office or in the visitor's pavilion here?
Now, say it's not so much in the visitor's pavilion, but yes, it is something we have to take into account. We have to take care.
Care, right. The telescope, you're saying it's built in the late 60s?
That's true, yeah.
Uh-huh. And it's owned by, it's operated by the Max Planck Institute.
Yes. It was also built on behalf of the Max Planck, Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy. That's mm-hmm. one of approximately 80 Max Planck Institutes within Germany for different branches of research. And at the time, it was possible by the support of a foundation, Volkswagen Foundation, uh-huh. but they had the building costs, but certainly not the maintenance costs. And the maintenance is by our institute, that means from Max Planck Society.
Yes. And you have some connections with Jodrell Bank.
That's true, yeah. That means we have joint project for quite some time going on, and our new director for fundamental radio astronomy, pulsar research and so on, Michael Kramer, or maybe in England he's known as Michael Kramer, he was at Jodrell Bank for quite some time as pulsar researcher, as professor, and he took over as one of four directors of our institute only in March last year.
Mm. What sort of work goes on? What kind of discoveries have been made with this telescope?
Yeah, the advantage of a telescope like ours, of these big parabolic dishes, is that they are very versatile. There's different kinds of research, be it covering the sky, that means making radio surveys, covering large portions of the sky in continuum. You can investigate spectral lines, that means high spectroscopic resolution, high frequency resolution, that is, mm-hmm. identify molecular lines and also physical parameters like density or temperature of the interstellar clouds from that. Third part is, as already mentioned, pulsar research, that means high timing resolution, since pulsars are rapidly rotating neutron stars, mm-hmm. rotating up to 700 times per second around its own axis, around their own axis.
Right.
And fourth mode of observations, and there actually Jodrell Bank and our telescope comes together again, mm-hmm. is VLBI, very long baseline interferometry, where you mimic a virtual telescope of thousands of kilometers in diameter mm-hmm. by switching together single dishes across continents, across oceans.
Right.
And there, with that method, you can achieve extremely high resolutions.
So you have done that with Manchester's Jodrell Bank, and you've of course done that with Great Arecibo as well?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what about Southern Hemisphere, parks in Australia?
Parks is not possible.
Right.
But for a reason.
Yeah.
That means we cannot switch together, we cannot join observations. That means observe the same source at the same time with a telescope there.
Yeah.
Since Parkes is at the antipode, or almost at the antipode from Europe.
Right.
And therefore, Parkes is doing VLBI as well, so Southern Hemisphere telescopes, also with Japan or China. That's possible, but not with old Europe.
Obviously, that makes sense. If you can't both see the same object in the sky, you can't combine the signal.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But you could do a joint observation if you have one source, say, in equatorial position in the sky, and have a campaign going on. Start with parks in Japan, for example, wait for some time, then Europeans and Africans may take over, wait for another time, and then it comes into reach for the American telescopes. That's possible, but not at the same time.
If you were to pick just two of the discoveries made here, which have made a contribution to science, which two would they be?
Oh, one of the last. And it's a somewhat funny or interesting result that's from end of 2008, That was the detection of the most distant water known in the universe so far. And that means it was possible with our telescope to detect water in a galaxy with a redshift of 2.5, and that corresponds to a light travel time of more than 11 billion years. It means it's a signal from a time when not even Earth or Sun did exist.
And that has many consequences, but first, the detection. Normally, if you're looking for water, the emission lines or absorption lines are not visible in radio frequencies. So did it have to be that far away for the redshift to shift it into your area?
They are visible. That means a lot of water is investigated. That's a water maser transition at a frequency of 22-something gigahertz, corresponding to 1.3 centimeter wavelengths.
Right.
And actually, in that particular galaxy, the water was detected at a frequency of only 6 gigahertz, 5 centimeters wavelengths. Right. That means it was that heavily redshifted that was transformed or transposed in a completely different part of the radio spectrum.
So there was some expectation?
It was a kind of guessed, intelligent guess.
Yeah.
We know the redshift of that galaxy from other lines.
Right.
And it's a galaxy in a very early stage in the universe. We would be interested. We have a receiver working in that frequency regime. Mm-hmm. And let's see whether water can be detected there. In the end, it was also some kind of, one other important ingredient was the following, that the light and also the radio radiation of that galaxy is enhanced by another galaxy in between, which works as a gravitational lens.
Right.
Without that lensing effect, it would have taken a consecutive observation of almost 2 years with our telescope in order to detect the line. And so, with a gravitational lens, only 16 hours when necessary.
So the gravitational lensing enhanced the signal to such a degree that it really made it practical to be observed from here. Whenever water is detected anywhere in the universe, it's a very popular question to ask, but what does
is
that
there
mean?
Life possible?
What do you think?
It only holds the other way around. Mm-hmm. Water is an absolutely necessary ingredient for all kinds of life we know about.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be possible without water.
Right.
But water is also a simple molecule.
Right.
Only two bits of hydrogen, one bit of oxygen, not so much more about.
Yeah.
And it could already form in a very early stage in the universe. The presence of water doesn't imply life in any case, but say it shows water is already there 11 billion years ago. If we investigate our galaxy in a bit more detail, closer star forming areas, we even detect complexer molecules, organic molecules, even also ingredients for life. It could have developed anywhere else, but we have no direct clue, no direct trace.
But this detection of water does give some picture of the early universe, in that the formation of stars and a supernova and the reformation of other stars leading to complex molecules had already been happening at a very early stage, 2.5 billion years old universe. So the idea of civilizations, if they do, we don't know if they exist, but if this is one indicator that life could have existed a long time ago in the universe.
And no, with water we are not at the very complex molecules and life. The chemistry taking place in star-forming areas, in interstellar clouds, leading to the, formation, another molecule which was detected by a colleague from the Bonn Institute, is aminoacetonitrile, and that's a close relative of the most basic amino acid of glycine.
Right.
And that was found in a star-forming area pretty close to our galactic center.
You're very very correctly sticking to your scientific approach, saying this is only what we've seen. You can't draw too many conclusions from it, but nevertheless it was quite a significant discovery. So that was water discovered very far away in the early part of the universe. What would you say is another of the contributions that's been
One of the contributions, it's not a first or an only, but say from my research, supernova remnants, in the course of these surveys of the galactic plane, 40 new supernova remnants have been detected here with the telescope, and that is about 20% of all known so far. That's not too bad.
What is LOFA?
LOFA is an acronym for Low Frequency Array, and that's radio astronomy in the meter wavelength range. And LOFA is a joint European project with the central station in the Netherlands and other stations being built or even working in other countries within Europe. Ours was the first international station, the first station outside the Netherlands, starting work at two different frequency bands. Let's come to the frequencies.
Okay.
That's a frequency range from 20 to 85 megahertz. Then there's a certain gap, and it starts again from 120 to 240 megahertz. And the gap is radio. 85 to 110 megahertz is a radio band.
You mean commercial radio?
Commercial radio.
Oh, I see. So it'd be very noisy.
I see. And that means LOFA is an internet telescope. That means each station, like ours here in Effelsberg, directly on site, consists of a number of dipoles, 96 single dipoles for that frequency range, connected via fast data lines.
Fiber optics.
Mm-hmm. To the that's an 11 gigabit per second fiber optic system connecting us with the German research net, and then further on to the central station in Holland.
I see.
And it means essentially the telescopes are switched together to a virtual telescope of hundreds of kilometers within Europe.
Right.
And that makes very exciting observation. The punchline from German doesn't hold in the English language. That means long wavelengths in German means Langwelle. And if something has long wavelengths, it's langwellisch. And almost the same word with one different letter is langweilisch, which means boring.
In terms of the work that LOFA is doing, what sort of observations does that do?
There's one very interesting point. We have already talked about the water detection here with the Effelsberg telescope. And if you put that really to the extreme, go to, instead of water, to a more basic ingredient, which is hydrogen. The most widely distributed stuff in the universe. And hydrogen normally radiates at 21 centimeter wavelengths, 1.4 gigahertz. And now imagine you have hydrogen from such an early time in the universe that the universe had only 1/20th of its present diameter.
I see.
And then the original hydrogen line from there is spread out by redshift from 21 centimeter to, say, 4 meters in wavelengths.
Right.
And then it comes into range for the low frequency array for LOFA.
And what sort of things have you seen with that so far?
So far, it's pretty early observations. It is covering the whole sky, and you can do it with the Effelsberg LOFA station within seconds, cover the whole sky with a crude resolution. Okay. And another thing which is going on, which might, I think it should be a press release coming out in maybe 1 or 2 weeks from now, which is a simultaneous observation of pulsars, of a set of pulsars with Effelsberg, with Strattelbank, and with LOFA in the high band and in the low band array. That means in four different frequency regimes almost simultaneously. And the funny thing with pulsars, with that rapidly rotating neutron stars, is the higher the frequency, that means the shorter the wavelengths, the further down in the atmosphere of that pulsar, the magnetic atmosphere it is, the magnetosphere of that pulsar, you can look. That means within the, say, radiation cone, that's the concept which is behind the pulsar. It's a very fast rotating neutron star, and with a very strong magnetic field, and the magnetic field really confines the radiation to a small cone, and every time the cone is hitting your telescope, you have a pulse of radiation, and that's, say, up to 700 times per second. And the shape of the pulse and the frequency of the pulse tells you something about the part of the magnetosphere of the star where it arises. And with that simultaneous observation in different frequencies, you can go down in that level, go down through, have a cut through the magnetosphere. And that's, say, the ingredient or the punchline of that, at the moment, future press release.
Oh, okay. That sounds interesting. You mentioned very briefly that the, and this is true for when you have optical telescopes and you go down to radio, you lose some resolution because of the longer wavelength.
Sure.
You're going down another step to low frequency, so the resolution is
very low. But otherwise, you have a telescope of a few hundred kilometers in diameter, and that increases your resolution.
Oh, okay.
The resolution of one dipole of our LOFA field is the whole sky as one point.
Oh, I see.
The whole sky. Right. Nothing in resolution at all.
Right.
But with 96 dipoles spread across a field of 60 meters in diameter, you have already a pretty crude resolution of a few degrees.
Right.
And with switching together different LOFA stations, kilometers or hundreds of kilometers apart, you gain higher resolution as well.
Right.
And simultaneously.
Dr. Norbert Junkers from the Max Planck Institute, thank you very much indeed for your time.
They say beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Well, here's another take. Today's quote is from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Beauty is a manifestation of secret natural laws, which otherwise would have been hidden from us forever.